This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Anchorman, the film satirizing local TV news shows of the 70s, has just come out on DVD. It was directed and co-written by our guest Adam McKay, who Terry interviewed when the film was in theaters. The anchorman in the film, Ron Burgundy, the top-rated anchor in San Diego, is played by Will Ferrell, who also co-authored the screenplay with McKay. McKay and Ferrell first worked together on Saturday Night Live, where McKay was head writer. He's an alum of the Chicago-based comedy theater group Second City and was a founding member of the Upright Citizens Brigade. The news team in the movie Anchorman covers all kinds of fluff with an affected sense of gravity. Let's get in the mood by listening to the opening of Anchorman's Channel 4 news show.
For San Diego news you can count on, trust only the best. The Channel 4 news team. With seven-time Emmy Award-winning anchorman Ron Burgundy.
I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Champ Kind with the latest in sports.
Whammy!
Rick Tamland with up-to-the-minute weather.
38 degrees in the Middle East.
Brian Fantana, your man in the field.
Panda watch. The mood is tense.
And our newest reporter, Veronica Corningstone.
It was quite a show down here at the Pet Shack.
So when you're looking for serious news, look no further than the Channel 4 news team.
Adam McKay, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Anchorman is set in the 70s at a time when local news had a lot less competition than it does today because it's the pre-cable era. how do you see like the importance of like, you know, the local news and the local news anchors in the period that your movie set?
Well, they were huge back then. That was three channels, so they really were like the voice of God in their community. And, you know, when they would do a promotional deal at a shopping mall or something, you would have like 30,000 people would show up for these things. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I lived in a little town outside Philadelphia. Don Tolleson, who was the local sports guy in Philadelphia, came to our town and literally 10,000 people showed up. And I got Don Tolleson's autograph, and it was like, you know, Elvis had whipped a sweaty towel at me or something. I was just as thrilled as can humanly be. And I'm not sure that would be the case anymore. I think Don Tolleson would be surrounded by about eight people in the park if that happened now.
Well, you know, it's such a really funny parody of the news. And you have your opening news collage in which, you know, all of the anchors and reporters walk onto the set. Would you describe how that looks?
Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, a lot of that came directly from real tapes we saw of the 70s news openings, you know, from Jessica Savage and Mort Krim back in the mid-70s. And basically the whole sort of theme that I'm sure they were thinking was, you know, we command the city. So it's a lot of pushes and tight shots. And then our favorite element of it is in the end, they had the entire news team all look up in the camera with a, quote, serious journalist stare at the same time. And instantly Will and I were laughing and saying that is just directly going into the movie. So that actually is in the movie, and that's taken from Mort Krim and Jessica Savage circa, I think, 75 or 76.
What are some of the favorite headlines that you wrote for Anchorman?
You mean the fake news stories?
The fake news stories, yeah.
Well, some of the best fake news stories were the ones Will just suddenly became a master at improvising these fake news stories, and he would always give you little tastes of them as you came out of other stories. And we would just marvel at the fact that he probably came up with 100 of them. What were some of my favorites? There was one he would do, Christmas in July, you ask? That's right, Santa's Village is coming to the local mall just for July, Christmas in summer. He did another one about San Diego being renamed Boz Scaggs Town for a big Boz Scaggs concert. It was always like the fun game of usually the bad stories involved animals. Like we had one that was after the bear destroyed the photo mat booth, he scampered back into the woods. And then Will goes, apparently he wasn't too happy with his color prints. And they both chuckle kind of inanely. But that one always made us laugh because, God, you know, a bear ripping apart a photo mat booth, that's a serious, dangerous story. And just because it's animals, they always play it off light. But animals were definitely the formula. We came up with just hundreds of different animal stories as that sort of being our comment on the local news and their regular stories.
You and Will Ferrell have written together a lot, beginning with Saturday Night Live. How much of this new movie is improvised?
We improvised hours and hours of footage when we were shooting. We would always do two takes as written, and then we would just go and go, and we rolled out all the time. You know, I'd have the cameraman just say, "I'm out," and if we had two cameras going, I'd let the other guy keep rolling. So I'd say as far as what made it to the actual movie, probably about 25%. I mean, there's whole scenes in the movie that came out of improv. Him crying in the phone booth was a one-line scene that he just expanded on. And I gave the brilliant note of keep going, only bigger, you know, which is a great note to give Will. And, actually the Afternoon Delight scene where they sing basically was improvised. Paul Rudd came to me about a week before and said, "Wouldn't it be great if we just sang a perfect four-part harmony version of Afternoon Delight?" And I basically right away was just like, "That's going in the movie." And like the day of, I told them that we were doing it, and they had only rehearsed it for like 10 minutes. So they just kind of came up with the whole scene and did the thing on the spot. So
well, I actually really love that. Why don't you explain the context of it, and then we'll play the song.
Well, basically, they're trying to understand what love is. So they're talking to Ron, and they just can't understand. So finally, he has to break into this perfect rendition of Afternoon Delight.
Well, let's hear it. So this is the cast of Anchorman singing.
Can I apologize?
Oh, for what?
Can I apologize to your listeners before they hear this? All right, let me give a warning to your listeners. If they're driving and they're about to hear this, you may start sobbing. You may want to hug loved ones. So maybe pull over to the side of the road before we play it.
Yeah, here it is.
You really want to know what love is?
Yeah. Yes, tell us.
More than anything in the world, Ron.
Well, it's really quite simple. Kind of like, gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight. My motto's always been, when it's right, why wait until the middle of a cold, dark night? When everything's a little clearer in the light of day, and we know the night is always gonna be here anyway. Thinking of you's working up my appetite. Looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together, making sparks ignite. And the thought of loving you is getting so exciting. Sky rockets in flight.
Woo!
Afternoon delight.
Whoop.
You guys have it, I think.
Afternoon delight.
That's Will Ferrell and several other members of the news team in the new movie Anchorman singing Afternoon Delight. Why that song? I mean, why did you all agree that this is the song that they have to do?
No, I think your answer is in the question, why this song? I think that's why. Why in God's name that song? That song explains nothing about love. It seemed like the perfect one to do four-part harmony on. It was either that or If, and If by Bread. And we didn't want to...
Wait, which one is that? Do a few bars of that.
If a picture paints a thousand words, then why can't I paint you? So you can see why we didn't do that one.
Thanks for refreshing my memory. I really hate that song, yeah.
Do you want me to keep refreshing your memory? Should I keep singing it? Or?
Oh, you don't need to.
Okay. What if I want to? What if I insist?
You're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome. Will Ferrell is so especially good at thinking that he's really smart and attractive. And can you talk about that thing that he has? I mean, like, there's a great scene where he's like, he's exercising, and he's just doing it for show. And he does not have, you know, like one of those...
Very careful here. Be very careful.
I mean, we see his body.
He
has a wonderful body, right.
He is. He's fantastic at playing those characters.
Give for that body. Yeah, go ahead.
I always say that's why his George Bush is so good. You know, he's the master of playing the guy who's, as Hightower said, born on third base and strutting around like he hit a triple. And that's definitely Ron Burgundy. They really, you know, they're in this mid-market. I always called the story a medium-sized fish in a small pond story. And they just think they're ruling the globe. And of course, he's got the mustache. So maybe he's not as wrong as we think.
How did you start working together?
We got hired together at Saturday Night Live. We were hired on the same day. So there was a group of five or six of us, writers and cast, that were hired, and we went out and got beers that night. And we all thought Will was the most normal guy in the world. I mean, he sort of looks like, what's his name, Wayne Rogers from MASH. And then when he started reading scenes and the read-throughs, we're like, holy Lord, he's demented. And instantly the entire writing staff just like fell in love with him. So then on top of it all, it turns out Will's a really, really great writer. And so, yeah, he and I just started sort of writing those strange kind of scenes they always put at the end of the show, the last half an hour ones together.
Can you describe what it was like to watch him work up his impression of George W. Bush?
It actually was a process. I remember the first time we put him in a scene as Bush, it was Clinton. It was Daryl doing Clinton and Bush kind of busting in saying, I'm on your tail kind of scene. Pretty soon this Oval Office is going to be mine. and Will just kind of played him like a frat guy. He didn't really do anything. He just kind of came in with a beer and was pumping his fist a lot. And the audience didn't know that much about George W. Bush, so they loved it, and it was just a beer drinking kind of frat guy thing. And then it was during the summer break when Bush started sort of emerging, if that's the right description, that Will really started watching him. And when he came back off the summer, suddenly he had all these little, you know, affectations that Bush always uses to sort of punctuate his serious and sincere moments. And once he figured that out, that was kind of the whole impression, was, you know, saying, making the word freedom last for 7 seconds, you know, freedom, you know, and... yeah, it, amazing, though. It was always a freakish impression. We could never believe it.
Did Bush ever give you feedback?
He actually would send us a turkey every Monday morning with a bottle of champagne and just a note that says simply, I love you.
I thought how generous.
No, I know. Actually, that's somewhat feasible, unfortunately. The only feedback I ever heard was I heard a story that I had written a sketch that was called Palm Beach Nights, and it was a soap opera version of the election, the recount scandal. And I had heard a story, it was like, I think in the New York Times or something, about how Bush came into his campaign office and his entire staff was gathered around watching this sketch, and with Will playing Bush, and he got very angry and turned the TV off and told everyone to scatter. And I was reading it going, wait a minute, that's my sketch. So that was the closest I had to feedback. later, Bush in the White House asked Will to come and pay a visit. And, you know, at the correspondence press dinner, and then I think later at the White House. And Will felt it was a little weird as a comic playing the president to go visit him, so he ended up not doing it. But that was the only other interaction.
There's a certain type of male that you have satirized in some of your sketches, and certainly in Anchorman. You know, like the frat brother kind of guy who's, you know, not very bright and is drinking a lot of beer, the kind of guy who thinks he's, you know, incredibly smart and has a, you know, absolutely perfect body, a real Adonis, and of course, you know, doesn't. And I mean, there's this great thing in Anchorman where one of the reporters puts on this cologne that he thinks is really, like, super great. And, of course...
Sex Panther, I think you're referring to.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But so I figure you were probably never that guy. And if you were, you wouldn't admit it on the show. But, but did you know, like when you were in college, did you know guys who were like this?
Well, you know, I went to Penn State for 1 year before I transferred to Temple University in Philadelphia. And at Penn State, if you're not in a fraternity, there's kind of nothing really going on for you. So I actually tried to kind of assimilate into the frat world and could never figure out why it never worked. And then finally, a couple of years later, I was like, oh, I'm so happy that didn't work. So, I mean, there's a little bit of us, and Will actually was in a fraternity. There's a little bit of us that kind of did some of this stuff. Like, I remember buying Polo cologne when I was like a sophomore in high school and putting on too much. I think part of it is that, yeah, we had our run-ins with this world. One of my favorite stories is Will was actually in a fraternity at USC. I was really surprised to hear this because we both like to kind of make fun of that world. And he told me that, you know, he joined just because he was new in college and stuff. And he said that one time he got up at a meeting in a very straight-faced way, said to his entire frat that perhaps they should go gay. because it would save a lot of money as far as their bills for parties. It would also cut down on liability issues with, you know, sexual assault sort of cases in the fraternities. And he said, and ultimately the main reason I want to do it is because this is about brotherhood, and I can't think of a better way to get closer than if we all went gay. He said, you know, half the frat was really laughing, and half of them were like, who is this guy? And kind of taking him seriously. And so, yeah, I think we're more in the world than I wish I could be cool and say I've always laughed at this. But no, I tried cologne and tried hanging out at frats, and it just never quite fit. But I think that's part of the reason we also like to laugh at it.
Now, you started off in Second City before getting to Saturday Night Live. Second City is famous for improv. Did you develop characters when you were there that you would do?
Yeah, we had some characters. I had a character I used to always do was the you still got to pay your taxes character, which this guy Scott Adsit and I used to love to do. And it was basically Scott Adsit would play a petition, an activist coming to my door. And he would ask me to sign a petition, a very clear petition about the neighborhood and how to help the neighborhood. And I just kept saying things like, you still got to pay your taxes. You can't fight City Hall. And would never sign the petition. And that would be the entire scene. And we would play that ad nauseum in improv sets for like 15 minutes because it made us laugh so hard. But I was never a big character guy. When I auditioned for Saturday Night Live, it was as a performer. And they asked me to do impressions and characters, and I knew I didn't really do impressions. And people at Second City don't really do impressions. That's not really considered that cool at that place for some reason. And so that's why I brought scripts with me. It was like, I better get in as a writer. And thank God I did.
Now, I read that when you were, I guess it's when you were still with Second City and you were living in Chicago, you advertised your own suicide, and then what?
I like saying, and then what, at the end of that. I did. I was with a group called the Upright Citizens Brigade in Chicago, and we did a lot of sort of improv sketch kind of street theater prank kind of stuff. I don't even know what you'd call it. And we did things like take the whole audience back to my apartment and let them watch a scene of a fake murder through my windows. We did a scene where Horatio Sanz, who's currently at Saturday Night Live, ended up getting arrested in the middle of North and Damon. He was leading a fake revolution towards City Hall, and we gave the whole audience plastic guns and tiki torches, and he ended up getting arrested. So sort of in the midst of that kind of work, I decided to advertise my own suicide, and I had this really horrible 8x10 I had done for some agent in an attempt to get commercial work of me with the cheesiest smile you'd ever seen. And I just put it in the poster, and I just said, on such and such date, Adam McKay, age, I think I was 27 or 24, will kill himself, no joke. And we went and put it up everywhere. And for us, it obviously was a joke, but some people were quite upset. So we ended up doing it. It was a huge turnout. And I actually got on top of a 5-story building and came out and yelled down to the crowd. And I had a CPR dummy that we had dressed in my exact clothes. And I backed up and tossed it off the edge. And you could actually hear the crowd go, and then we had a character playing the Grim Reaper come out to claim me. And then my friends paid off the Grim Reaper. And I came back to life. And we went back into the theater. And it was great. It's the kind of stuff you could not do in New York or L.A. because you would be arrested instantly. But somehow Chicago was slightly spread out enough that you could get away with this stuff for like 10 minutes.
I'm trying to figure out what I think of this, you know, whether I think it's hysterically funny or just like so unfair to people who think that somebody's truly about to kill themselves.
I don't think anyone really thought I was going to kill myself. I mean, I had some people complain to me about it. And to me, it was we were so clearly making fun of that, you know, sensationalistic thing. That was the whole joke of it. We advertised it like it was a, you know, a 5-day pass at Disney World to come see this guy kill himself. So, but I can't believe, I think for a second when they saw the dummy come over the edge, there was a little flash of, wait a minute, is he actually crazy? So, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about it either.
And was Action News there?
I wish they had been. They would have, what would their line have been? And for one comic, it was not a very funny night.
That's right. That would have been it.
Adam McKay speaking with Terry Gross. He directed and co-wrote the film Anchorman, just out on DVD, and the upcoming film version of Bewitched. This is Fresh Air.
May I take your order?
Yes, I am going to have 3 fingers of Glenlivet with a little bit of pepper, and some cheese. Very good.
I'll take a Manhattan and kick the vermouth in the side with a pair of steel-toed boots.
Certainly.
Thank you, Scott.
Mr. Burgundy!
Gino!
So good to see
you. How are you?
Would everyone love to hear Ron Burgundy play some Jazz Flute? Yes! Please! Good, get on stage now.
Okay, come I guess on. I can play a little ditty.
Honestly.
Come on! Give him a hand!
I'm not prepared. I really am not prepared at all.
Yes!
This is a surprise, I tell you.
Guys, East Harlem Shakedown, E flat. Keep the cymbals splashy, and Jerry, let's take the bass line for a walk.
Hold on. I'm not hearing it right. Hold on.